happens with some kind of return. The law, the current law, the current disconnect does not address the problem when that situation happened. It addresses, at least somewhat, the problem that there's going to be a difference and that you're going to have a separate basis, but it does not address the earnings from that. And so we have, by rule, exempted that, just like the contribution, unless it was distributed. And so what this would be doing is putting actually into law that if you have a difference in the amount that federal allows and what Oregon is allowing, and you receive some kind of dividend or interest from that, that that would be exempt from tax until it was distributed.
Yes, Representative
Scott. Well, the few schools, federal government does not tax interest from excess contributions.
Representative Skeen, that is correct until it is distributed. That's right.
Yes, Representative.
So the obvious question is, why have a contribution limit if it's not taxed?
Why have a different
Representative Skeen?
Probably because the principal amount is non-taxable. It would be a heck of a way to get some interest-free or tax-free interest, seems to me. Just make excess contributions.
But isn't that what you're proposing?
Pardon me?
You're proposing that the contribution, the excess contributions, is not taxable until it's distributed. They are not taxable until it's distributed. So if we have a $2,000 limit, I can put $2,000 a year in my IRA. What happens if I put $5,000 in?
Representative Hugo, right now that wouldn't be allowed for federal purposes. You would have to include that back into your income because you're only allowed under federal law to take $2,000.
So the $3,000 additional would be taxable income then?
That's right. That's right. The situation, maybe I didn't make myself clear, but the situation that we have here is where the IRS, and they have thought about it several times, but it has not passed a different amount than the $2,000 amount. So this would be, remember, the bill would tie us to December 31, '84, and let's say after that time, they would move that $2,000 amount to $2,500.
Okay.
Okay. What's addressed in current law is that the plan would not be disqualified for Oregon purposes if they made changes like that. But it doesn't address the interest computations and things like that that occur because of that difference in amount. So on your federal return, you would be able to take, let's say, $2,500 instead of $2,000. On the Oregon return, you would have to back out $500, but you haven't received really any interest from that. Well, you have, but you haven't got it per se. You can't take it out of your IRA, for example. And so what this bill does is exempt that unless you receive it. If you get that out of your IRA fund, then it would be taxable.
Okay.
It doesn't forgive the interest taxation. It just puts it off into the future, just like the $2,000, for example.
Okay. Thank you.
Going back to your example, the Oregon would still be $2,000, not $2,500.
That's correct. It's just the interest on those excess amounts.
Representative Scott?
Okay, the excess contributions, you're using it here, is excess contributions purely for state purposes, doesn't relate to excess contributions for federal purposes.
Representative Skeen, that is correct.
Okay.
Here we got one.
I wish I had said that earlier. Okay, on item number 8, this deals with interest for the qualifying interest deduction. Currently in the law, we have a 200 and 400 interest exclusion. An interesting thing happened because of the tie again. We were tied to, and it currently is in the law, to the qualifying definition in IRC, the Internal Revenue Code 116. The IRS now has repealed that section and that defines qualifying interest because they don't have qualifying interest exclusion anymore. They only have the dividends. When that happened, we lost the qualifying definition, even though it referenced IRC 116. And so we had to ask how to address that for the tax booklet purposes, and we got an informal opinion. And they said, since that section was repealed, that basically any interest qualifies for the interest exclusion. And so some things that did not qualify under IRC 116 It does qualify now. An example of that is if on a personal contract, if I sell you a car and I charge you interest on it right now, that would qualify for the 200-400 exclusion. Previously, it did not. So what this would do is go back to what we thought the intent of the legislature was by tying to IRC 116 and make those items that were not allowed previously to not be allowed now, like the private interest on a contract.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hugo.
I wonder if it was it a legislative policy decision to tie to 116, or was it just a convenience?
I don't know, Representative Hugo. It is written right into the statutes. I don't know if that was just done, you know, by the tie and then the language accompanying it, or whether it was actually a decision.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Scum.
Since the Oregon law ties to the IRS code at a certain date, how could you lose the definition? Wouldn't the definition still be effective until we changed it because it was based on the law as it was then, not the future?
Actually, it wasn't even in effect in December 31, 1982. It had been changed before that time.
Oh, so we did it ourselves.
Okay. Indirectly.
Okay.
Okay. Item number 9 is really more of a clarification. In 1981 and 1982, there were items where S corporations had income totally attributable to modifications like ACRS. In 1983, that was addressed by the legislature. And when that happened, and it was totally attributable to those modifications, they were allowed to back that out and then come back to a zero income. What item number 9 does is really clarify that basically that should occur, where the S corporation gets back to a zero income, and the modification, the ACRS, for example, would be reported on the personal income tax return. So it just makes some clarifications in those items. It also, in item number 10, clarifies when there's a basis adjustment requirement when the assets are disposed of. The law requires certain basis adjustments to be made, and it does not include all of them. For example, an investment credit. There's a federal investment credit. Oregon doesn't have one. It requires federal basis adjustments, and it does not say how to address those in the Oregon law, and what this section would do is address that. It would actually make a modification or a change in the basis for Oregon purposes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Does it make it conform to federal purposes? Federal basis adjustments? Or would we still have a separate computation for state and separate for fed?
Representative Skinner, it's a little bit hard for me to know. Basically, because we'd be connecting to ACRS, that would not have to be one of the changes. But because we're tied to December 31, 84 law, some other things could be passed by the IRS which could affect us similarly. So right now it would get us back to where it would be the same as federal in most cases. But there could be a time, like in 1986, for example, where that may not be the case any longer if they did something like ACRS again.
For the current period, however, it would be the same as the Fed.
Generally so, yes.
Okay.
And item number 11, this would require that an Oregon net operating loss would be the same as federal net operating loss. Because of modification in certain court cases, what was that court case?
It's Bechtold versus Department of Revenue.
Bechtold versus the Department of Revenue. We have to make some modifications to the federal net operating loss. And so for on the personal income tax side, what this bill would do would be whatever you had as a net operating loss for federal purposes, you would have the same amount for Oregon purposes. Now sometimes that's going to be an increased net operating loss, and sometimes that's going to be a decreased net operating loss. It also clarifies an interest starting date. Again, in the 83 session, they changed the interest starting date for net operating losses. Currently, a net operating loss can be taken back 3 years, and it used to be that the interest starting for those years it was carried back to would start 4 months after the due date of those back year returns. So,
Representative Scone.
Tell us how the interest relates to net operating loss and the carryback.
Okay. Under prior law, if I have a loss today and I file my 1985 return, for example, and I carry it back 3 years, that loss back to my 82 return, the interest starting date would start, so the 82 returns are due in 83. So
Whose interest? What is the interest? I don't understand what the interest is. I don't understand.
The refund interest. They're going to carry back the loss and get a refund from it.
The state's
going
to pay the taxpayer?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. So it's refund interest. So on my 1982 return, that interest would start from 4 months after the due date of the return, which would be April 83. It would begin 4 months after that due date.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hammer?
Is that 18% we're talking about that Mr. Love and his client was talking about earlier?
Representative Hamlin, yes. Okay, what was done in the 83 session then was to make that interest not start from those back years. What it started was from the loss year return, so that would be 4 months after the due date of this year's return, my 85, so it wouldn't start till 86, for example, or until it was filed, and that's what this does. What happened was there was a glitch in the law, though, and the way the language was constructed, we had to ask for an informal opinion, and it would appear that it would be 8 months after the loss year returns due date. Since several people had been here for testimony and it had been decided that that was supposed to be 4 months after the due date of the return for the loss year, this is just a clarification.
Can you tell us about the loss carrybacks now? I thought that we did not permit loss carrybacks.
Representative Schoon, in personal income tax we do. In corporations we don't.
Okay, and this is just personal?
That's correct.
Okay.
In item number 12, this would provide a certain treatment which is called the Internal Revenue Code 338 treatment for certain qualified stock purchases on or before August 31st, 1982. By tying to December 31, 1982, there were certain stock purchases made by people on a federal level. They could treat them one way, and on Oregon, they had to treat them another way. There was this small window period, and we got a few telephone calls, and generally the amounts were so small, and they would be so hard to find in an audit situation, that what we were recommending here is that we would have, for purposes of this treatment of these stock purchases, that we would tie basically to the August 31st, 1982 date for those stock purchases. And then item number 13, this would allow regulated investment companies to deduct dividends from Oregon taxable income to the extent that that interest from state and local bonds were included in their federal taxable income. Right now, we have a rule that does that, but this would put it into statutory form, so it's more of a clarification. And then in item number 14, this would clarify, this was actually put in at the request of Barbara Seymour because she saw a glitch in the laws. We have our own rehabilitation deduction, the IRS has there, and generally they have been the same amounts. I think ours is $25,000. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And the Federal Tax Act in 1984, I believe, is going up to like $35,000. So what this section would do is say that when there's one allowed at the federal level and the Oregon level, that they would basically be limited to the amount that would be allowed on their Oregon return.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Berlina, is that rehabilitation, like for injured workers or machinery or buildings or what?
It was in Hamlin. I'm going to let Don McNeil take that one. He's for buildings, I believe.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to clarify because that word is used widely.
Right. For the record, my name is Don McNeil, Department of Revenue. Representative Hamlin, the rehabilitation expenses here that are allowed as a deduction are for revisions to a building for easier access by the handicap.
Ah, thanks.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
Only for easier access? There's couple of sections of the law that talk about rehabilitation. Historical buildings, for example. There's another section that applies to, I think, just older buildings that permit substantial rehabilitation expenses to be treated a little differently. I'm not very familiar with that, obviously.
Representative Schoon, in Section 27, it has the language for the rehabilitation deduction. It generally looks like it's mostly the easier access.
I believe that's correct. John, what you're referring to is in other sections of the law.
Okay.
Okay, and then item number 15 would tie us to December 31, 1984 for ACRS and then 179 method of depreciation, which is an expensing, direct expenses for amounts of under $5,000.
Yes, Representative Schoon.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to that rehabilitation
right.
deduction and ask if this also is a change in policy. It looks like this is a completely new subsection. And that previously we might have permitted these deductions irrespective of what the federal government did. And if it is it a policy change?
Representative Schoon, is not intended to be. It's supposed to be picking up the same treatment and the same, almost same wording, although I don't have that language with me. But when I talked to Barbara Seymour, that's what it was supposed to do, as in the personal income tax section. They apparently addressed it in one area and didn't change the wording in the corporations when they tied to December 31, '83. And she raised that concern, and it is not to change policy, but we can check just to make sure, because it's not intended to change policy.
Okay.
In item number 15, it allows ACRS in 179 for items placed in service in taxable years beginning on or after January 1, 1985. What the interim bill does is allow those for placed in service items after December 31, 1984 in tax years ending after that date. So it's a wording change. And when I talked to Barbara Seymour about these when these bills were being drafted, she decided to leave the language differently so it could be placed as a policy decision for the legislature. The next handout, which has some little graphs that are kind of confusing, it was supposed to be clarification, and Don goes, oh, fine, I wonder if I understand. So, but basically what happens with a different language, calendar year taxpayers would be treated the same. They would be able to, for assets placed in service after December 31, 84, would be able to use ACRS in 179. But it's where fiscal year taxpayers come into play, that there are some differences. Ian.
Representative Schoon.
Do we know what the fiscal impact difference is?
Representative Schoon, no.
Is it possible to determine that, Steve?
I have to think about it. I'm not sure that it is, but I'll try to give you some idea of what it is.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hugo.
Before we go into the bar deals, which I've been looking at for the last 15, 20 minutes, why are we doing this? Why are we recommending this change for 15?
I'm not sure I understand, Representative Hugo.
Why in House Bill 2011 do we have this change going to the beginning, tax year's beginning on or after 1/1/85, as opposed to December 31st, '84.
Representative Hugo, the language in 2011, and Don can correct me if I'm wrong, is the way that we have connected historically.
Yeah.
And so that's why 2011 was drafted that way. I don't know why the other one was drafted the way it was.
The other one, 2236, I believe was drafted that way because that's the way the feds typically change their beginning date.
On the ending day of the year?
Yes.
12/31 as opposed to 1/1. There are two changes. One is 1/1 versus 12/31. The other one is based on tax years beginning at a point in time or ending at a point in time.
Right, and one was to conform to the way Oregon has done it in the past, the other to the way the feds normally do it.
Okay. Now what is 2011 doing? That's the way Oregon has done it in the past.
That's correct.
2236 is the way the feds have traditionally done it.
Right. That's my understanding, yes.
So the question is, why are we doing it in the 2011 manner?
I think generally from a standpoint of ease, if you had a 1985 return from either a calendar year taxpayer or a fiscal year taxpayer, they would both be allowed ACRS. And if you use the wording in House Bill 2236, they would not. One would get ACRS and one would not get ACRS. The calendar year taxpayer would get it, the other one would not.
Okay.
Representative Scrooge?
Well, don't we just have a little administrative problem also, because if, say, a lot of people filed their returns before we passed the law, then they would need to amend their returns if we had an effective date for tax years ending after 12/31/84, so that anybody that had a tax year ending between 12/31/84 and the time that we passed the bill and it became law would have to amend their return if they wanted to take ACRS.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Schoon, that is correct. For those fiscal year taxpayers that have a tax year ending in January or February or March, they may file the return before the session is over and the effective date of the bill. So then they would have to go back and amend to do that.
Any more questions relative to that?
Just like to see Galena go through the chart.
Well, at last night at about 11 o'clock, it made a lot of sense, Representative Hugo, looking at today. You know, it was basically to show you that if you had a tax...
Anything made sense to me last night at 11.
What?
I said I don't think anything made sense to me last night at 11. Okay. Very calm.
It was basically to show that if you had a tax year that began prior to January 1, 1985, and in the situation with item number 2 that happened, you had one that began in December of 1984, for example. And in that instance, that taxpayer would not get ACRS. And then in House Bill 2236, it was again to show that if you had a taxpayer that had a tax year ending after December 31, 84, that person would qualify for the ACRS.
Obviously, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hugo.
Obviously, on the second example, the fiscal taxpayer's year is December through November.
That's right? Correct.
Okay.
That FYE is fiscal year end.
That's the only abbreviation on here I knew.
You didn't know place in service.
Obviously, there's a little policy question, but I don't think we'll deal with, make any policy decisions today. Do we have any more questions? Yes, Representative Hanlon.
Madam Chair, I want to go to somewhere other than ACRS and the chart. Are we going to continue on with that first?
But we're going to quit in 5 minutes, so ask your profound question.
Well, I don't know how profound it is.
On this issue.
But when are we going to be working further with this bill?
Tomorrow.
I've got a comment to make, and I'd just like to point out that on page 9, section 18, and if I recall Verlina's testimony, section 18 was to make our code in conformance with litigation that occurred in case law, if I recall correctly. No.
I just realized what you said. Now, Representative Hanlon, it would not require the modifications that were required to be made in a 1974 Bechtel Supreme Court case. Right now, you have the federal laws, and then you have to make certain types of modifications, for example, state tax refunds, etc., that were required to be made by the Bechtel case, and this would not require that to occur.
Okay. In any case, my objection to Section 18, and I don't think it's directed at the department, but it's a comment on how we draw our laws, and perhaps legislative council could take a look at this. Sub 3 says, in essence, if anywhere else in our tax statute there appears, I object to the word appears to require something different than this new Section 18, then we should ignore anything else and go to new Section 18. That's what subsection 3 says to me. My objection in drafting, our laws are already complex enough. Either subsection 3 is not necessary because subsections 1 and 2 of Section 18 take care of it, or subsections 1 and 2 should go correct the part of the law that appears to be in contradiction to it. Either or, I just think we're creating drafting problems upon drafting problems by amending the law in this manner, especially when we have CPAs coming in saying simplify, simplify, and I agree with them. We're making it more complicated. So that's just a comment that on how Section 18 was drafted.
Madam Chair, may I respond
to
that?
Yes, please do.
The bill drafter, which I believe was Ira Jones at the time, put that language in because there's an intent section, and I don't have that language in front of me, but the intent section that basically says we're tied for taxable income to federal law, and it basically says that there are certain things, certain adjustments that are made to certain definitions that have to be adhered to accomplish that. And basically what he was trying to do with this language was just to tie this section and that intent section together. So if it appeared under the intent section that a modification or a change should be made, that it would not have to be made if it was directly contrary to this one. So if it's not clarification, then, you know, I have no objections, or I don't think anybody would, to having that deleted. He basically put that in just for clarification. Yes?
Just in responding to that, either it belongs or it doesn't, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes,
Chair.
Scott?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
You can't tell the difference. I'm not going to make a point.
Is Ira still there?
No, Ira retired. But I'm certain that, you know, there's somebody over that could address that better than I could even. It really did have, though, something to do with the policy statement is, like, maybe 4 paragraphs or something, and it makes some broad statements. And it was because of that broad statement that the Bechtolt case occurred, and he thought it would be for clarification purposes to put that in. Yeah.
Please don't misunderstand me. I didn't want you to go get him and bring him over.
Oh, good. I don't know where he is.
He's a great guy, but he gets a lot of appears and wherefore.
Oh.
We're going to go into the
blow-up. Yes, we're going to quit.
Escape for 2 minutes then.
We'll be back tomorrow.
Yes, we have some amendments on the unitary provisions that Don needs to explain.
Now, have you seen this? Do you have this?
We have this. We have just barely started looking
at it. Okay. All right. We'll see you in the morning.
Thank you.
Well, you're also going to provide us answers on item number 6 to do what needs to be done to prevent conflict with the bill we just passed, 2737 or 5700.
Yes.
And then on number 14, you were going to check on whether that's a change in policy, right?
I will report back.
Okay. Appreciate your help, all three of you. It's been confusing and enlightening. Thank you. We're going to close our hearing on the income tax conformity and clarification and open the work session on House Bill 2565.
Well, we're switching places. I might comment about Ira. Ira is a great guy, and he
do a lot, but it seems to be, everything seems to be much clearer and much explained in a much better way this time, for some reason. I don't remember.
Oh,
he
yes.
I spent a week trying to figure out what he said.
I've been on this since 77. It's like in 76. What, dear?
Yeah, right. That's right. You never wanted to accept what anybody else said.
I mean, not like you're attacking God.
Yeah.
Bill Love? Bill, would you mind just giving us a little background on how you arrived at these amendments, if you're comfortable with that?
Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, I'm Bill Love, an attorney in Portland, Oregon, and here again on the amendments to 2565, House Bill 2565. Following my last appearance before the committee, I met with representatives of the Department of Revenue, Gary Humphrey and Verlinda Crosley, and we talked over some of their concerns, of our concerns relating to the issue.